Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Donald Trump inflaming the combustible situation with North Korea with name-calling and threats that play to his base but could ignite a catastrophic war. Norman Ornstein, a contributing writer for The Atlantic and co-author of It's Even Worse Than It Was, whose forthcoming book is One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported, joins us. We will discuss whether there is a method to Trump's madness in continually riling up his base with overheated attacks on his enemies while constructing an alternative reality via propaganda pumped out by Fox News and Sinclair. In addition to unlimited financial backing from billionaires and ongoing efforts to suppress the vote, would this be enough to keep him in power, particularly as long as the Democrats fail to exhibit leadership and offer a narrative beyond Trump is a disaster and if you vote for him, you're an idiot, a refrain which Hillary Clinton ran on unsuccessfully. Then we'll get an assessment of why South Africa's President Jacob Zuma has faced 6 no-confidence votes in Parliament and how he dodged the latest bullet in a 189-177 vote, despite mounting evidence of his corrupt ties to the wealthy Gupta brothers. Ambassador John Campbell, a former U.S. ambassador to Nigeria, who was political counselor to the U.S. Embassy in Pretoria during South Africa's first non-racial election and is the author of Mourning in South Africa, joins us to discuss how long the ruling ANC can excuse corruption while clinging to the moral authority bequeathed to them by Nelson Mandela. Then finally, we'll examine the sudden reversal of the Justice Department in withdrawing support for a case before the Supreme Court challenging how voters were purged from the rolls in the important swing state of Ohio. Justin Levitt, a professor at Loyola Law School who served as a Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Civil Rights Division of the DOJ, joins us to discuss how much the Trump Justice Department switching to support Ohio's aggressive purging of voter rolls in the middle of a case is tied to the administration's wider efforts at voter suppression via the Kobach Commission. And joining us now is Norman Ornstein, a contributing writer for The Atlantic and a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research. He's an election eve analyst for the BBC and the author of numerous books, most recently the New York Times bestseller, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, co-authored with Thomas Mann, now out in an updated version, It's Even Worse Than It Was. Welcome to Background Briefing, Norman Ornstein.
Thank you, Ian. I actually should tell you about the next book, which is out September 19th, with Tom Mann and also E.J. Dionne, the title of which is One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported, which will fit very nicely into our conversation today.
Right. But it makes the assumption that there is a post-Trump America. And with today's remarks about North Korea in the face of an incredibly explosive situation with a highly unstable regime, where the Secretary of State recently made very imaginative and mature approaches suggesting that we may be not interested in regime change. He's obviously trying to reach out with an olive branch, and this he gets undercut, and this all explodes in our face. I mean, we have a president who's playing with fire.
Of course we do. And when you said with an extremely unstable regime, I wasn't sure whether you were talking about North Korea or the United States at this point. We have a president, I'll be blunt, who is a 71-year-old lifelong narcissistic sociopath who also has almost no knowledge base and almost no impulse control. And when you're dealing with that kind of situation and confronting North Korea, it's explosive. And if you have a president feeling under intense pressure as the investigation of his behavior, not just with Russia, but clearly going back to a number of his other financial dealings, some of which are with Russian oligarchs and gangsters, perhaps, with grand juries convened, you know, you have to be even more concerned about policies that might be taken that are not done with necessarily the long-term best interests of the country and its national interest at heart.
So do you think that we have false comfort in the idea that there are some adults in the room? I'm not sure that Mattis, McMaster, and now General Kelly are in fact in the room. You seem to see more of Bannon and more of Sebastian Gorka, who is, by all reasonable definitions, a Hungarian fascist. I mean, these people are dangerous, I think.
One of the things that has happened, at least since General Kelly came on board, and I'll preface that by saying that General Kelly has not distinguished himself as a balanced figure as the head of the Department of Homeland Security. The policies that he's pursued and condoned by his ICE agents have really been more than troubling. But Kelly moving to the White House, one of the first things that he did was to give a lot more rein to McMaster to begin to purge the place of some of the previous Flynn people who are themselves both inexperienced and without policy views that any of us would feel comfortable and safe with. They're not all gone, and Sebastian Gorka remains a major figure. And of course, now that Kelly has given McMaster the ability to get rid of some of these people who are continuing to stick around, we're seeing the right, including clearly heavy emphasis by the Russians with bots, going after McMaster in a big way. We know that Trump has tepidly given his support to his national security advisor, but we also know that the national security advisor, who's a sane and rational person, has not been in the room with meetings with Putin, with meetings with other foreign leaders. And we have to worry about who will be there when the president makes some of his decisions. But it's also a question about whether General Mattis, General McMaster, or the others around him will go along with those things without some strenuous pushback.
Well, I find it a little surreal that you have the Attorney General, who himself has been humiliated and insulted by his boss, be sort of stepping up to the plate and talking about how he's going to go after leakers and Trump himself, of course. When he said that he was annoyed or disappointed in Sessions, it's said that he's been very weak on intel leakers. I mean, isn't it a bit extraordinary to have a situation where you've got a government that is under suspicion, at least a president and his close circle, and particularly his family, under suspicion of colluding with the Russians, and all of this focus on leaks, including the most recent one, which was, of course, revealing Trump's appalling lack of knowledge, experience, and any kind of sense of diplomatic behavior in these crude and ignorant transcripts of his discussions with the Mexican and Australian leader. Now, everybody says, and they're quite right, that there should be a certain level of privacy that presidents have. But on the other hand, the person who leaked that and the people that keep leaking from this leaking sieve of a White House, clearly, surely, they seem to be motivated by an alarm, trying to tell the American people, this is who you have elected.
And, you know, I think you focused on a lot of the right things. It makes me uneasy to see leaks of private conversations between world leaders, because future presidents are going to be more careful about what they say to world leaders. But certainly the substance of these leaks and the earlier stories that we heard are extremely alarming. You know, the conversations about Sessions, the sliming of Sessions by the president, basically furious because Sessions had done what was exactly the appropriate thing to do, having been involved deeply in his campaign and having lied to Congress about having met with Russians. If he had not recused himself from the Russian investigation, it would have been an absolute scandal. That tells you something about Trump's mindset to begin with. And then when you talk not just about leak investigations, but about dragging journalists in and changing the rules there, you're really seeing some of the elements of an autocratic mindset that are themselves troubling. And I'll tell you, when I look at a Congress that's decided that there should be a higher priority on investigating Hillary Clinton 8 months after the election and not looking at collusion with Russia, or even more, the obvious stepped-up Russian efforts to undermine American democracy and to steal our secrets, that shows you that the unease shouldn't just be about Donald Trump. It should be about others who are enabling him and not providing the kinds of checks and balances that the system is supposed to provide.
But if these Russian troll farms are still spewing out bots that are helping Trump and going along with the way that he's solidifying his base, then this has hardly stopped. I mean, clearly he's alarmed at what's happening with this, with Mueller, and he's made it quite clear that he'd like to fire him, and he's annoyed with his attorney general because he didn't fire him. I mean, this is not the behavior of an innocent man. There's something there that's troubling him, whether it's Mueller having hold of his tax returns. But just to pull back a bit and look at this in the historical context, have we ever had a president, even a senior official in any government in the history of this country, that could be suspected of treason? I mean, this is at the heart of this allegation, or this allegation of collusion, is the possibility that either you have a honey trap, a money trap, or something that Putin is holding over Donald Trump. Now, of course, it hasn't been proven, but the mere fact that it's out there and it's clearly bothering him is just so unprecedented, and it seems to my mind dwarf everything. I mean, I don't see how you can go after leakers when you ought to be able to come clean to the American people and reassure us that you're not some kind of Manchurian candidate.
So let's throw in a couple of other elements here. We have a Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, who has announced that he will not spend $80 million appropriated by Congress explicitly to fight Russian cyber attacks and ISIS cyber use. Then you throw in the fact that Medvedev, the number two leader in Russia, did a tough tweet about the weakness of the Trump administration when it signed the president let through the new sanctions bill. And we got nothing, no response from Trump. But when he's on his, as he says, working vacation at his Bedminster Country Club, and it's a rainy day so he can't be out there playing golf, and he insists that he's working hard, within a few minutes after Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal appeared on CNN, Trump issued a storm of tweets ripping Blumenthal, who served in the military, for having lied about his having been in Vietnam. So he's attacking almost everybody else who even touches on him, but doesn't give a single word about Russia, even when a Russian leader attacks him. All of that is just bizarre, and it's hard to find another explanation except that he is, in some fashion, in league with, in thrall to, or maybe being pushed by, for nefarious reasons, Putin and the Russian regime. The good news here is that Mueller has assembled an extraordinary team of people. At least some Republicans in Congress are backing up Mueller, and it is there's a pretty good chance we'll get to the bottom of some of this, except that along the way, Trump may do some things that are really difficult, troubling, dangerous, destructive, over the line, and we have to be on guard.
But why then does Trump's base not see the obvious here when he attacks Blumenthal, who did obviously had he had academic or educational deferments during the Vietnam War and eventually joined the Marine Reserves. And on a couple of occasions, apparently, he conflated serving in the Marines during the Vietnam War with being in Vietnam. And he's apologized profusely for that. Donald Trump, on the other hand, had educational deferments, and then he got a deferment finally because of a bone spur. He went on the Howard Stern show to brag about how he got out of Vietnam, and his Vietnam was the contracting venereal disease from all of his many sexual partners as he was celebrating on the home front. Why do his supporters? I mean, we saw what it did to George W. Bush and what it did to Bill Clinton. This Vietnam business does hang over a lot of people of that generation. But this guy has skated, and I don't for the life of me understand why.
So let me try and put it into a frame that I think fits. Keep in mind first that our politics have become increasingly tribal. And we tend to view our tribal leaders through a different lens or prism than others do. Our politics are driven by negative partisanship, which means you are less attached to the positive side of what your own party identification represents and more to a fear and loathing of those people in the other party who are hell-bent on destroying America's way of life. Now, throw into that a kind of media mix now where most people, or lots of people at least, cocoon in and hear only what they want to hear. And then watch, and you see a lot of this actually on Twitter, of people who are monitoring the three cable news networks and point out that whenever there is news, for example, about Russia or Russia's collusion, stories about Michael Flynn or Paul Manafort or Jared Kushner or Donald Trump Jr. that are dominating CNN and MSNBC, Fox is running a story about Hillary Clinton. So for Trump, who has cultivated this base, and it's filled with lots of people who believe that elites in America have viewed them with contempt in some cases, and in other ways that the Democrats are an evil, awful collection of people, any criticism of Trump redounds to the benefit of the people you hate the most. And so there is a rallying around effect and a psychological impact here. Now, many of our pundits have been wrong in the past in believing that that core for Trump was not going to change and that it was around 40% or even a little bit more. And then it was around 38%. Well, now we have surveys suggesting his approval is around 33%. And even that could erode a little bit, especially as he indicates his willingness to sabotage what exists in the healthcare system in the Affordable Care Act. And out of spite, has talked about blowing it up. People who benefit from that, and that includes a lot of older voters and a lot of working poor people, but also plenty of middle class people who, for example, rely on Medicaid for nursing home care for themselves or their parents or grandparents. Some of this may erode even a little bit further. But the more he cultivates that base, while refusing to try and reach out to a broader audience, as every other president has tried to do, the more they get determined in their support for him, because abandon that support and you're in effect giving aid and comfort to the enemy. And that means he may last a little bit longer. It means more intimidation for Republicans in Congress, because his base is their base too in primary elections. He's got support from some billionaires who could come after them in primaries or provide a lot of support for them through unpopular policies. But of course, it also means a much, much greater division in the country that is extremely destructive.
Well, just in closing, could it work? Could there be a method to his madness? In other words, it is puzzling, yes, that he keeps throwing red meat at his base and that it is shrinking and that a lot of more traditional Republicans are finding it insupportable and unsustainable to make excuses for this compromised president who's manifestly incompetent. could you use, for example, Sinclair and Fox and Hannity and Boris Epstein and all of these characters in a Putin-like distortion of reality and with a propaganda blitz along with Kobach's commission to strip people from the roles? Yeah. I mean, is there a way that a combination of anti-democratic and Soviet propaganda means could be enough to sustain him, because there really isn't any democratic opposition that I can identify.
You've got, I think, a key point here, that if you combine the support from billionaires and very wealthy people, a lot of which is with the expectation that they're going to get a gigantic tax cut, with a media that in many ways now resembles a fairly large state-run media, not just like what Putin has, but also like what, for example, Erdogan now has. And you combine that with the way in which he is getting this base to move even more firmly on his side, and put that together with the fact that as Republicans in Congress inch away from him, they face enormous blowback from a good part of their own core. And look at how, for example, the book that Jeff Flake has just done, harshly criticizing Trump, a courageous thing to do when he's up for re-election next year. But his approval rating at this point in Arizona is 18%. And that's not likely to encourage a lot of other Republicans in Congress who are appalled by Trump to move beyond an occasional tut-tut, we don't like this behavior. But if we get into more and more dangerous territory, territory that could really threaten the fundamentals of the country itself, then we'll see some moments of reckoning. And we simply have to hope, especially in the Senate, I think the House is a much harder body to feel optimistic about, that a lot of people who care, to use Lindsey Graham's phrase, about country above party, will begin to rise to the occasion. Those moments of reckoning are yet to come.
Well, just to go back to our original opening remarks about this North Korea crisis, which is getting worse because Donald Trump is throwing gasoline on a very combustible situation. We may even be there before, sooner than later. I thank you for joining us, Norman Ornstein.
My pleasure, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Norman Ornstein. He's a contributing writer for The Atlantic and a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research. He is an election eve analyst for the BBC and the author of numerous books, most recently the New York Times bestseller, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, co-authored with Thomas Mann. Now, in an updated version, It's Even Worse Than It Was. His forthcoming book out soon is One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back getting an assessment of why South Africa's President Jacob Zuma has faced 6 no-confidence votes and how he dodged the latest bullet. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Ambassador John Campbell, the Ralph Bunche Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and a career Foreign Service officer and a former ambassador to Nigeria. He was political counselor at the United States Embassy in Pretoria during South Africa's first non-racial election And his latest book is Mourning in South Africa. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador John Campbell.
Thank you very much.
And it looks as though South Africa's President Jacob Zuma has dodged a bullet. In this case, for the sixth time, there's been no confidence votes leveled against him in the parliament. This was a pretty close vote, 198 to 177. So it did indicate that there were some more and more defections from the ANC, his party, and the Speaker allowed the vote to be recorded secretly so that people didn't have to, put their hands up or whatever method they have there to be identified. So it feels as if there's a move afoot to try and ease him out, but he obviously has got some resilience, has he not?
He does have some resilience. A couple of figures here might be helpful. 400 seats in the National Assembly, of which 249 are held by the ANC. As you pointed out, the vote was secret, so we don't know how many ANC MPs voted for the resolution, in other words, expressing no confidence in the government. But an estimate would be somewhere between 20 and 30. We can't know because there are a number of minor parties in the South African parliament, and they may well have either their members may have either abstained or voted against the motion. But still, it looks like there was some between 20 and 30 ANC MPs who voted for Zuma to go. Important to keep in mind the upcoming chronology of events. Zuma faces the possibility of impeachment proceedings in September, and in any event, he will be out of the ANC presidency in December. He cannot succeed himself in his term as president of the ANC is up then. Not his term as president of the Republic of South Africa. That lasts until 2019. But his party leadership ends in 2017. A second somewhat minor point, but still worth bearing in mind. A no-confidence vote, if it had succeeded, would have meant that the entire South African cabinet would have had to resign. That would include the president, Jacob Zuma himself, and his allies, but it would also have included members of the cabinet who are opposed to Jacob Zuma and who are actively campaigning to succeed him as party leader in December. So many sort of nuances here. What we should not do is take the vote as evidence of confidence in Jacob Zuma. There really is no evidence of that he retains the confidence of many people in South Africa.
Well, I think the press have been exposing corruption for some time, have they not? Particularly his relationship to the powerful Gupta brothers,
who many
see as a kind of, the eminence grise, I can't think of the right word, behind the throne, but they've certainly have quite a lot of influence in South Africa's business community. And, of course, they use the charge of racism, curiously enough, to defend themselves and the attacks on both them and President Zuma by suggesting that the white establishment, the white business establishment, is singling them out because of they're successful, and they, of course, are Indian South Africans or of Indian descent, and therefore, the white establishment looks down their nose at them. Does that play?
In general, race continues to play a role in almost all aspects of South African political life. Part of that is because in the 21 years or so since the end of apartheid, while there has been really quite stunning political progress, South Africa has probably the most advanced constitution in the world and is characterized by a very strong civil society, the rule of law, and independent judiciary.
But in terms of social and economic indices, the progress of the 80% of the population that is black has been painfully slow. And in fact, the gulf between white wealth and the wealth of everybody else in South Africa is greater now than it was at the end of apartheid. So there is an ongoing sense of grievance amongst the majority population about how slow economic and social progress has been.
Well, just to briefly go over the court problems or the cases against Zuma since he came to power in 2005. He was charged with corruption over a multi-billion dollar arms deal. Also in 2005, he was charged with raping a family friend. He was acquitted in 2006. And in 2016, court orders that he should be charged with 786 counts of corruption, which he appealed. Again, in 2016, the court ruled he breached his oath of office by using government money to upgrade his private home. So he has since repaid the money. And in 2017, the public prosecutor said that he should appoint a judge-led inquiry into allegations that Zuma profiteered from his relationship with the wealthy Gupta family. So he certainly has attracted a lot of legal heat, has he not?
He has indeed. And an important aspect of South Africa is that civil society is extremely strong and the press is absolutely free. This means that corruption is a lively public issue in South Africa and it is widely reported on. South Africa, you know, on the subject of corruption, is somewhat close in terms of public attitude to where we are. That is to say, while no doubt there is always corruption, corruption is always unacceptable. So corruption is a major public issue in South Africa in a way it is not in certain other countries where, in fact, corruption is vastly more pervasive.
So, but does corruption, obviously, in all cases, I think, impacts the poor. I think almost by definition it benefits the wealthy. And you do have that tremendous economic divide between the black majority and the white minority still. So what prevents the black majority from being, in other words, what's the glue that keeps them supporting the ANC? Because I don't think they can forever sort of cash in the moral high ground that was bequeathed to them by Mandela. Isn't there a younger generation of ANC leaders who are very restive?
You're absolutely right. Though there are a couple of things I think to bear in mind. The first is that the so-called born frees, people born after the end of apartheid, roughly the equivalent of our millennials, rather like our millennials, they very often don't vote. In other words, those who vote in South Africa tend, in terms of age profile, to be quite similar to those who vote in the United States, which means the elderly and the middle-aged are, as a part of the electorate, overrepresented. People, in other words, who have a personal memory of apartheid and a personal memory of Nelson Mandela. The second point is that the ANC is losing political support. It did quite poorly in the 2016 local government elections, and its leadership is concerned that in the next national elections, its share of the vote may fall below 50%. If it does, the next government will not be an ANC government. It almost certainly would be a coalition government in which the ANC may or may not be a leading partner. There is a feeling pretty widespread in South Africa that the ANC is losing its sense of vision, that it's increasingly detached from its natural constituency in the townships and in the rural areas. And those of the Mandela generation those who were leaders of the ANC during the transition to non-racial democracy, most of them that are still alive are harshly critical of the Zuma administration.
Well, he seems to be getting a lot of heat from the political left, the ANC's alliance partner, the South African Communist Party, and also the Coalition of Trade Unions, COSATU.
Yes.
They basically asked Zuma to quit, didn't they?
They did indeed. That's correct. That's right. Yeah, he is getting a lot of heat from them. The South African Communist Party is a fairly strange animal and quite different from communist parties elsewhere. But amongst other things, it represents itself as a party of conscience. And it particularly has been quite critical of the corruption of the people around Zuma. COSATU is also critical on the basis of corruption, but some of the constituent elements in COSATU are interested in possibly establishing a democratic left-wing political party that could challenge the ANC, something along the lines of the left wing of the Labour Party in the UK. So you've got a lot of political ferment going on now in South Africa. It's no longer a place where politics was essentially dominated by one party, the ANC.
But is there a ANC or a South African equivalent of Jeremy Corbyn emerging?
I suppose you would take Julius Malema as the closest equivalent. He's charismatic, he's fiery. His party, the Economic Freedom Fighters, got about 6% of the vote in the 2016 elections. He gets an awful lot of attention on social media. He is quite popular amongst the young, amongst the born frees. But again, their turnout on election day tends to be low.
So how does this Zuma fit into this unfortunate pattern in Africa of the so-called strong man? And you only have to look at South Sudan to recognize the extraordinary tragedies of what these strong men do when they come to power. In the case of South Sudan, the world's newest country, of course, the two strong men then have over a personal squabble, have essentially destroyed their country and
they have indeed
impoverished millions and murdered or created a condition of sort of genocide and counter-genocide in a tribal sense. So it's a huge tragedy. And so I've never been able to get my head around it, why, you know, there is this problem with strong men, and there are some questions about even the vote in Kenya today and yesterday in terms of Kenyatta having those tendencies. So where would you put Zuma in that? I mean, obviously, you can't compare him to the warlords in South Sudan, but still, he does have the strongman tendencies, does he not?
There's a huge difference. Jacob Zuma's power is severely constrained by South Africa's liberal and democratic constitution and by the strength of the country's institutions, and also by the independence of its judiciary. If we're looking for comparisons, the position of Jacob Zuma is more similar to that of certain strong politicians in Western democracies. In other words, they may make a lot of noise, but their ability to actually do things is severely constrained.
But is there any comparison, for example, with Mugabe
No, there's none at all. He's destroyed the independent judiciary, destroyed the rule of law. Right. The Constitution is a joke. And he rules essentially through his security services. So no, there is no comparison.
Right, and he's a major kleptocrat. But doesn't he also, to some extent, use the anti-colonial credentials that he has? Is that something you can accuse Zuma of?
Not really, no. Mugabe certainly does, yes.
Yeah.
No, not really. Zuma has to bear in mind that there are something like 5 million white people in South Africa, and they dominate the economy, and they are also the source of most money that's available for domestic investment. In addition, there are a similar number of so-called coloreds, people whom we would regard as of mixed race, but they regard themselves as a separate race. South Africa is an immensely more complex place than Zimbabwe. And because of that complexity, occasionally Zuma will indulge in what appears to be anti-colonial rhetoric, but it's not very significant, and he doesn't get a whole lot of attention when he does it.
But what explains why he gave Omar Bashir, who is the Sudanese leader who the International Criminal Court have an indictment against and an arrest warrant out for him, and he was basically, I think it's pretty clear that Zuma let him slip out of South Africa when there was international pressure to arrest him. This is back in 2015.
What the Zuma government said at the time was that it rejects the notion that the International Criminal Court had jurisdiction over sitting heads of state. Now, in the case of South Africa, the treaty by which South Africa adhered to the International Criminal Court, that has been made a part of South African law. And the South African judiciary has ruled that, in fact, the ICC's indictment of Bashir was legal under South African law, and that, therefore, the Zuma government should have turned him over to the ICC. That case is still outstanding in the South African judicial system and is one amongst many of Zuma's numerous legal problems.
But the bottom line is that Bashir escaped the ICC and international justice.
Oh, he did indeed, yes.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Ambassador Campbell, and filling us in on somebody's political tenure that he seems to, this is the sixth time he's dodged a bullet, as we mentioned. But I guess the impression I get from you is that maybe Jacob Zuma's days are numbered.
Well, they're very much numbered. I mean, he leaves the party leadership in December. The ANC's tradition, though South African law does not require it, is that when the party leadership changes, the outgoing party leader resigns the presidency, and the incoming party leader becomes the president of the Republic of South Africa. That is the most likely outcome of December. So the question becomes, who wins the ANC leadership race in December?
Well, Ambassador Campbell, I thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Ambassador John Campbell, who is the Ralph Bunche Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, a career foreign service officer and a former ambassador to Nigeria. He was the political counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Pretoria during South Africa's first non-racial elections. And his latest book is Mourning in South Africa. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining the sudden reversal of the Justice Department in withdrawing support for a case before the Supreme Court challenging how voters were purged from the rolls in the important swing state of Ohio.
Democracy is coming to the USA.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Justin Levitt, election administration and redistricting, and his work has been cited extensively in the media and in the courts, including by the U.S. Supreme Court. Welcome to Background Briefing, Justin Levitt.
Thanks very much.
And we learned that on Monday, the Department of Justice reversed its position on a very important voting rights case before the Supreme Court that involves the purging of voter rolls in Ohio. And is there something to be worried about here, particularly when you've got the Kobach Commission underway, which many people feel is sort of operating under the false pretenses, or at least based on a false premise that there is an epidemic of voting fraud in the country? So the indications, at least to my mind, are that there's something troubling going on here.
I think there are two troubling indications here. One is the substance and one is the process. So on the substance, what the Department of Justice has said is that Ohio can purge people ostensibly for moving, even when there's no evidence whatsoever that they've moved. So based purely on the fact that someone hasn't voted in a little bit and hasn't responded to one mailing, Ohio says they can presume that they've moved and purge them from the voter rolls. And that is a disturbing interpretation of federal law, which prohibits you from tossing somebody from the rolls just because they haven't voted. In addition to that substance, I think it's disturbing that the Department of Justice had a different view last week than it has now. In fact, in this very same case, the Department of Justice submitted a brief, and full disclosure, I actually worked on that brief. But in this very same case, the Department of Justice submitted a view saying this is what federal law requires in the Court of Appeals in Ohio. And now today, the Department of Justice has reversed position and said, no, sorry, I know that we said the law requires X before, but now we say the law requires not X. That happens from time to time, but it's rare, and it's quite rare to happen in the same case.
Well, of course, the previous Ohio Secretary of State, is he not on Blackwell, Ken Blackwell, is he not on this Kobach Commission along with the Vice President and some very radical voter suppression? I don't know how you describe them fairly, but I think they have basically earned the title of being voter suppression zealots.
Yeah, the commission, which thankfully thus far has been separate from the Department of Justice, but quite a bit more disturbing, actually. The commission is run by the Vice President and by Secretary of State of Kansas, Kris Kobach, both partisan officials, both running for partisan office, including Kobach running for governor right now, both from the same party. And they've stocked the commission with quite a few other people who are known for making wildly inflated and unsupported claims about the rate of voter fraud. And I think all expectations are that they're going to do the same thing here with the intent to encourage states and to encourage the federal government to actually change the current protections in federal law. That's even going a step beyond, several steps beyond, considerably beyond what we saw at the Justice Department. And I think, thankfully, you're seeing some pushback to the Kobach Commission, pushback from the states, pushback from state officials who actually know that they've run relatively clean elections in the past. And I will hope that the Supreme Court gives some similar pushback to what the Department of Justice has said yesterday.
But in the work that you've done on voting rights and this, what seems to be a very questionable premise that there's a rash of voter fraud in this country, it seems to me that we are distinguished ourselves from the rest of democracies of having one of the lowest turnouts in voting. We have voting on a work day, Tuesdays, not the weekends, which everybody else seems to do. In Australia, for example, you get fined if you don't vote, and they have a regular 90% turnout. And what that means is that the people of Australia actually have representative government because even, for example, the most conservative government Australia had in recent years ran on a platform of fully paid 6 month pregnancy leave for all Australian women, including their significant others. That is a platform that even a Democratic Party in this country wouldn't even embrace. And I bring it up because I think it indicates that if more people vote, which is the purpose of democracy, then the government has to respond to the majority, not the minority.
Yeah, we certainly have a lot of structures in this country that are not particularly helpful in encouraging lots of people to come out to vote. And some of that is from a basic orientation. We don't tend to think of voting in this country as providing customer service. We, the customers, are all of the people who are eligible in this country. And there are some local election administrators who are really, really good and actually do have that orientation. I'm fortunate to live in Los Angeles County, where I think that the registrar, Dean Logan, has actually taken a number of steps toward improving customer service. And there are some other registrars across the country who have that perspective on a local level, but that's rarer than it should be. And there's an awful lot of state and federal laws that don't encourage people to get registered, stay registered, to vote when they can. And that's something that I really wish we could change and should change. There are a lot of steps that we can take, actually, that are relatively uncontroversial, that are bipartisan. Actually, a good way to see these is the work of a prior commission put in place in the Obama administration in 2013, convened a widely respected Democratic campaign lawyer, widely respected Republican campaign lawyer, state officials, local officials, and even, and this is important, people from business, because it turns out that customer service and logistics are a big part of the election process, and there are some members of business community that spend a great deal of time, effort, and money on customer service and logistics. And they came up with a number of pretty broadly respected, very modest, very bipartisan, and very widely agreed on recommendations. Some communities have taken up the call, and a lot more have not. I would welcome a lot more attention to what that body recommended, because we'd all do better in putting those things in place.
So could you make the case, though, that the Kobachers of the world have sort of had a victory of sorts, in the sense that what they're proposing should be considered by all American citizens who believe in their democracy and who celebrate it on the 4th of July, that it is simply wrong to not want people to vote, not encourage people to vote, make it difficult for people to vote? You can't call yourself a democracy if you do that. Your orientation should be to make sure everybody votes and find it, you know, find ways to make that as easy as possible. How has the mental process in this country shifted to where it appears that a lot of Americans accept the idea that you should be able to purge rolls, you should not be able to vote in this country, that people can get away with this kind of subterfuge, which is less and less subterfuge now, with the open intentions of the Kobach Commission made pretty clear?
I think it's going to take people being active and speaking out. And it turns out that local administrators, I keep coming back to this because it's super important. You know, a lot of the election process that we have in this country is localized. And it turns out that many local administrators actually respond when people talk to them, when people complain to them, when people volunteer with them. And that means it's, unfortunately, but also fortunately, it's incumbent on us to step up and let them know what we want and what we demand. You know, an awful lot of the process, an awful lot of the experience that people have at the polls starts with poll workers, and those are people volunteering of their own time or getting paid a pittance in order to show up for really long, really hard hours to help others actually exercise the franchise. In a microcosm, that's what more of us have to do all the time, every day. In terms of cleaning the rolls, so I think it's important to recognize that actually everybody benefits when the rolls are clean. When the rolls are clean, that means you can find yourself in the poll books. That means that administrators can plan. That means that you have to wait less time in line. That means that everybody has more confidence in the process. And all of those are a good thing. Cleanliness in this respect is actually a good thing. The problem is when people get overzealous about the cleaning and sweep out eligible voters along with those who are ineligible. So the process of maintaining the roles is a lot like surgery. You want to do it carefully, you want to do it precisely, you want to have really good tools, and you want to make sure you've got a really skilled doctor. And in those circumstances, surgery can actually be really helpful. It can be life-saving. If you do it sloppily and you don't have the right tools and you're working on a shaky table and poor lighting, and you've got a doctor who went to auto mechanic school rather than med school, surgery can be pretty dangerous. And I think the same is true here. The things that we've seen most recently are a sloppy attempt to wipe the rolls clean rather than a surgical attempt to make sure that eligible people are on the rolls and then ineligible people are off. We should all want the latter. We should all want the rolls to be clean and accurately reflect the electorate. And we should all be willing to fight harder against people who want the process to be a whole lot sloppier.
Well, of course, in a lot of other countries, including next door in Mexico, you're automatically registered when you're 18 if you're born in the country. And that's it. You don't need to register since that point. So, again, even registering to me looks like an impediment. I know we have to accept that as a reality, but I still question it as a necessity.
Yeah, and I would say we don't all have to accept it as a reality. So you're right in pointing to a few things. Number one, that there are a lot of countries around the world that learned from us, right, that borrowed from features of our Constitution that they thought were really important for representative democracy and that improved on what we have. And as a result, there's now an awful lot that we can learn from others, if only we have our eyes open. The second thing is that you're right that the registration system we've got is largely a product of a registration system from the 1860s and 1870s, and in many ways sort of looks and acts the same that it does then. It's wildly out of date in some states. Some states have taken really strong steps to modernize the registration system, to drag it into the 21st century. And that means that they're taking steps to make sure that people are registered when they interact with the government for a whole bunch of other reasons, when they go to get a driver's license, when they go to get financial support, when they otherwise interact with the government, to make sure that they get registered and stay registered unless there's any reason to believe that they're ineligible. And that sort of difference in approach in modernizing the registration system so that you get on once early and then you stay on when you move, you know, for better or worse, my university where I went to school keeps track of me wherever I go. I can't get away. They spend an awful lot of time and effort making sure they can find me. And there are some states that are taking steps to have the same approach with the voter rolls. And that's a good thing.
Well, Justin Levitt, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Of course. Thanks for having me on.
And again, I've been speaking with Justin Levitt, who's a professor at Loyola University Law School in Los Angeles. He previously served as a Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Civil Rights Division of the United States Department of Justice and is an expert on election law who focuses particularly on election administration and redistricting. And his work has been cited extensively in the media and in the courts, including by the United States Supreme Court. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.